What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, FBI Director James Comey breaks his silence, saying he's, quote, mildly nauseous over the idea that he could have tipped the presidential election. And with a fiercely conservative governor leading the fight, is Kentucky about to become the only state in America without a single abortion clinic? It's Thursday, May 4th.
As the old saying goes, for somebody as famous as you, you don't need any introduction, so I'm going to just introduce you as director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
On Wednesday morning, James Comey gave his first public explanation for why, less than 2 weeks before Election Day, he notified Congress about new emails related to the investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server. Matt Apuzzo was there. Matt,
yes,
thank you for coming on.
Oh,
I'm going to say hello.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Get in the gate. Okay, Matt. Thank you for coming on.
Great to be back, Michael.
So describe for me this testimony today on Capitol Hill.
It was 10 a.m. and the FBI director, Jim Comey, walks into Senate Judiciary Committee hearing room.
Thank you for having this annual oversight hearing about the FBI. I know that sounds a little bit like someone saying they're looking forward to going to the dentist, but I really do mean it.
And right off the bat, the top Democrat on the committee, Dianne Feinstein, goes into the Hillary Clinton case and his decision-making in that case.
Why was it necessary to announce 11 days before a presidential election that you were opening an investigation on a new computer without any knowledge of what was in that computer? Why didn't you just do the investigation as you would normally, with no public announcement?
And you could see he got worked up.
Look, this was terrible. It makes me mildly nauseous to think that we might have had some impact on the election. But honestly, it wouldn't change the decision. Everybody who disagrees with me has to come back to October 28th with me and stare at this and tell me what you would do. Would you speak or would you conceal?
And you could see that he was animated about this. This was not the guy who was so comfortable testifying for the Senate that a lot of staffers jokingly call him Senator Comey. This is a guy who clearly was on his heels trying to explain something that, frankly, a lot of people are just not going to accept his explanations for.
And I've lived my entire career by the tradition that if you can possibly avoid it, you avoid any action in the run-up to an election that might have an impact, whether it's a dog-catcher election or president of the United States. But I sat there that morning, and I could not see a door labeled no action here. I could see two doors, and they were both actions. One was labeled speak, the other was labeled conceal.
And the way he's framed that makes it really hard to argue against what he did. But a lot of people, including some people in the FBI and many people at the Justice Department, say, yeah, but that's not actually the choice you had. Mm. The choice was follow the rules. The FBI's rules, the Justice Department's longstanding guidelines are we don't talk about our ongoing investigations. We don't confirm what we're investigating. And we don't do anything that's going to jam up a federal election. So just follow the guidelines and keep your mouth shut. We just heard Hillary Clinton say she would have won but for this moment.
You know, if the election had been on October 27th, I'd be your president. And it wasn't. It was on October 28th, and there was just a lot of funny business going on around that.
Matt, as a reporter who has covered this whole saga the closest, the whole investigation by the FBI into the Hillary Clinton's emails, what's your biggest takeaways from this testimony by James Comey?
So I talked with Mike Schmidt and Adam Goldman, my colleagues, who and we've covered this whole thing for months, and we all agreed he clearly has internalized this. He's clearly hearing the criticism. I mean, how could you not? So that was one takeaway. The other takeaway is One of the reasons why Jim Comey feels so strongly about the decisions that he made was because he has framed his choice in a way that gives him only two bad options. And this chasm is not something that he is going to build a bridge across to help people who are really critical of his decisions say, oh, I agree. I understand now.
Right.
They do not even agree on the framing of the choice he faced.
We honestly made a decision between those two choices that even in hindsight, and this has been one of the world's most painful experiences, I would make the same decision. I would not conceal that.
Matt, thank you very much.
Great to be here, Michael.
At Wednesday's hearing, Comey disclosed some new information about the investigation into Clinton's emails. He told senators that Clinton's top aide, Huma Abedin, appeared to have been forwarding emails, sometimes classified, to her husband, Anthony Weiner, asking him to print them out so that she could give them to Hillary Clinton. We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray. And that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to the New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Cheryl, how many abortion clinics are in the state of Kentucky right now?
One.
Just one?
Just one.
Cheryl Stolberg is a national correspondent at the Times. And what's happening in Kentucky right now that would explain that?
Well, what's happening in Kentucky is the governor of Kentucky.
This is not a game.
Matt Bevin.
You look at the degradation of things that are happening in our society. You look at the atrocity of abortion. So many have remained silent.
Who is a Republican who calls himself unapologetically pro-life.
It's a slippery slope. First, we're killing children. Now it's this gender-bending kind of don't ask, don't be a bigot. Don't be unreasonable. Don't be unenlightened, heaven forbid. Just keep your mouth shut.
He's blocked a new Planned Parenthood clinic from performing abortions. He's moved against and shuttered a clinic in Lexington. And he's threatened to close this last clinic in Louisville. And the clinic is now suing the state, backed by the American Civil Liberties Union, and a trial is set for September.
Cheryl, how do you legally close an abortion clinic?
Well, the governor's moved in a couple of ways. In the case of Planned Parenthood, Planned Parenthood built a brand new clinic in Louisville under the preceding governor, a Democrat. It's a reproductive health clinic. It offers a broad array of services, and it built the clinic with the full expectation that it would be able to perform abortions. The state says the clinic lacks necessary transfer agreements. These are agreements that the clinic has with hospitals and ambulance services to transfer women out of the clinic in case of emergency.
And this is news to me, but states have a lot of tools and ways to throw up barriers and make it very hard to operate a clinic that provides abortion.
Yeah, states have a lot of tools, and state legislatures have a lot of tools. So around the country, states have been enacting increasingly aggressive restrictions on abortion, restrictions on the procedure, say no abortions after 20 weeks. In Kentucky, the legislature recently passed a bill requiring doctors to narrate an ultrasound, whether or not the patients want it. That doesn't go to whether or not a clinic can stay open. But, you know, there are sort of a variety of ways that states and state legislatures can kind of chip away at Roe v. Wade that have made it hard for clinics to do business in some cases.
And you visited this final clinic in Kentucky. What did you hear from the physicians there?
Well, I interviewed one doctor there. He's been performing abortions very quietly in Kentucky for 37 years. Mm-hmm. He actually founded this clinic in 1981 with two partners, both of whom are now dead. He kind of feels like the last man standing in a way. He told me we're under assault. He feels very strongly that women should have the right to control their own reproductive health. He's an African-American man, and his mother had 10 children, and she also had 3 miscarriages. And he told me that he always felt that his mother was a slave to her reproduction, that that is what prompted him to begin offering abortions as part of routine OBGYN care in Kentucky. He also told me that many OBGYNs in Kentucky oppose abortion. And I've heard this from women also in Kentucky, that some who seek abortions are afraid to tell their own OBGYNs because there's such a stigma attached to it. And you could really feel that stigma in the clinic.
What do you mean?
Well, first of all, there were protests outside.
God hates the hand that shed innocent blood. Thou shalt not murder. You ever heard of those?
So women have to go through this phalanx of protesters just to get in.
I don't kill children. I raise children. But you slaughter children, which is worse than abusing children, worse than not paying child support. You kill them.
And then inside, one woman told the clinic counselor that she really wrestled with this decision to have an abortion, that she was a religious woman, but she was trying to escape an abusive relationship. And she said that she had cried a lot over it, and she hoped that God would understand. And she said, we need this option.
Cheryl, did you speak to the people outside the clinic who were protesting abortion and who maybe were involved in electing this governor and trying to make abortion hard, if not impossible, in the state? What did they say?
I did, and he is a hero to them. There are protests outside the clinic every single day.
You sinners are in big, big trouble with God.
They made their baby together, this baby together, and it's their own flesh and blood.
There are many regulars. There's one woman whose name is Donna, who comes every day, and she drives a white Mercedes, and in the back of her car, there's a Virgin Mary statue strapped into the seatbelt. Every day, she tries to usher women who are headed for the clinic into another center nearby, right next door, in fact, that is a Christian crisis pregnancy counseling center. A lot of the protesters outside the clinic are men, and they come in various stripes. There are some men who just stand outside and quietly pray and finger rosary beads. There's one pastor named Joseph Spurgeon who is very...
What you're about to do will be the killing of your child.
I would say aggressive.
The murder of your son or daughter.
In his protesting, he stands outside the clinic with a bullhorn and he...
Anything is better than killing your child.
...shouts toward the clinic so that the women in the waiting room can hear him.
To take the life of your son or daughter is murder.
When I was there, a young woman was carrying a toddler and she carried her toddler with her into the clinic and one of the protesters screamed at her, you're taking a baby into an abortion clinic where they're going to kill another baby. All of these women come into the clinic escorted by volunteers who are wearing orange vests. But as far as the protesters, obviously they are delighted with their governor and they feel he's ending a scourge or seeking to end a scourge in the state.
It feels like what you're describing points at some of the divisiveness across the country right now. And I wonder, for example, if you could contrast the situation in Kentucky with a democratically controlled state. How many abortion providers are there in, you know, a state like New York, for example?
You know, the situation is really night and day. The Guttmacher Institute, which tracks abortion policy, says that as of 2014, 218 abortion providers were in New York, 95 of them abortion clinics. So the access is, you know, almost unfettered in New York as compared to Kentucky, where it is so difficult in so many ways. One OBGYN in Kentucky, in rural eastern Kentucky, told me that she had trained in New Jersey and that she was so shocked because in New Jersey, if a woman wanted to terminate a pregnancy, she'd likely just go to a clinic or go to her OBGYN and it would be done and that would be it. And in Kentucky, the hurdles are so vast. First of all, it's a large state. Now there's only one clinic left. Women have to travel maybe for, you know, several hundred miles to get there. Previously, women could go maybe in the western part of the state, maybe they'd go to Nashville where there was a clinic. But now Tennessee has enacted 48-hour waiting periods. So that means two trips to the clinic. That makes it all the more difficult for a woman to get herself there. The surrounding states like Ohio and Tennessee are also enacting restrictions, limiting access. Kentucky's not the only state that has just one abortion clinic. There are seven. In fact, West Virginia just dropped down to one abortion clinic just this year. So there's really this patchwork across the country around access to abortion that is very, very striking.
So what's likely to happen in Kentucky? Does it seem likely that this clinic, this final clinic in the state, will be closed?
If I were betting just based on the judge's preliminary order, the final clinic will probably remain open. And that's because the judge said that the clinic had a strong likelihood of success. And the ACLU, which is handling this case, says that should this clinic close, there would be an effective ban on abortion in Kentucky. And after all, Roe v. Wade is still the law of the land. So I think the betting is that the clinic will, in the end, be able to remain open. But it's not going to happen without a fight.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Thank you, Michael.
Here's what else you need to know today. The Times reports that President Trump plans to mark the National Day of Prayer today by signing an executive order that would make it easier for religious groups to participate in politics. Under current federal law, religious groups can lose their tax-exempt status by supporting or opposing a candidate, a restriction that Trump says denies religious leaders their right to free speech. And two Republican lawmakers who had come out against the House plan to repeal the Affordable Care Act have reversed course and are supporting it, after the plan was updated to offer more support to people with pre-existing medical conditions.
So we're making good progress on some improvements to the bill. We've got some momentum, and so we feel really good about that.
Speaker Paul Ryan and other Republican leaders are trying to round up the votes to push the bill through the House today. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.